Okay, folks, we'll start with a song on page 47 of the songbook. Go down, Moses. We'll sing the first and the last verses. 47. Shall we rise, please? Musicians in the group may have noticed that Ruth was playing in a different key from... Well, we're lighting the candle again today. I could have dedicated this candlelight to different people. For example, Yuri Orlov is going to arrive in New York City any moment. From Moscow, the dissident. Also today is Rosh Hashanah, the first day of the Jewish New Year. But instead, I'm going to say something personal and dedicate this light to the memory of my parents, both of whom left Russia as youngsters and ultimately came to this country. My father ran away from home when he in a little town near Minsk. When he was 11 years of age, he was running away from a horrible stepmother. And as he's walking down the road, he was picked up by a couple in a wagon. And this couple were a member of the Jewish Bund. It was a socialist group that was being persecuted. They picked him up, sort of adopted him, and took him to Paris, France, where he ultimately became a shoemaker. My mother worked in a clothing factory in Kiev as a seamstress, as a teenager. And one day the women in the factory went on strike, and what was the major issue of the strike? What I'm holding in my hand. These women there was no electricity, they had to work by candlelight. They had to provide their own candles. And what the strike was about is they wanted the owner to supply them with candles. The strike lost. This is one of the reasons my mother and her mother moved away from Russia to France, where she ultimately met my father. Perhaps without this candle, you wouldn't see me standing here today. The reading today is a very brief Jewish-Russian saying. When Ivan steals, Ivan is called a thief. When Abram steals, all Jews are called thieves. When Ivan steals, Ivan is called a thief. When Abram steals, all Jews are called thieves. Ruth and I have made the acquaintance of a couple that lived down the block on our street, on Waukesha Street. I don't know if any of you know Henry and Ludmilla Shapiro. Henry was the chief of UP, United Press, in Moscow for God knows how many years. He told me that he once interviewed Khrushchev, spent several hours with him, and the subject turned to anti-Semitism. And Khrushchev said to Henry, "You can't accuse me of being an anti-Semite because my son married a Jew, and my grandchild is Jewish." But then Khrushchev went on to say, "But nevertheless, you just can't trust the Jews." And Henry said, "Why?" And Khrushchev said, "I, in my reign," or whatever you'd call it, "we allowed over 200,000 Russians to travel abroad. And of all those 200,000, only two people defected, and both of them were Jews." Henry said, "Well, you know this chap, Grushenko, I don't know if any of you remember Grushenko, but Grushenko was a Soviet code clerk in Canada, and he defected, taking all the Soviet secret codes with him." And Henry said, "You know General Vlasov, during World War II, the traitor who organized a tremendous army of prisoners of war to fight against Russia? These two men were Russians. How come you don't say Russians can't be trusted?" Khrushchev ended the conversation right then. Well, the service this morning is the fourth in the series of Eight Who Dared. The daring young man this time is a gentleman called Mark Asbell, who is an international renowned physicist, who, like others in our series, defied convention. He didn't fit the mold. He was out on a limb. He protested against repression in the Soviet Union. And he became a refusnik. A refusnik is a person, usually Jewish, who applies for emigration and is refused by the Soviet government. And he's put in a state of limbo. He or she is put in a state of limbo. They usually lose their job, their professional job. They lose their apartment. They have a pretty rough time, generally harassed by the KGB. There are an estimated 20,000 such lifelong refuseniks in the Soviet Union today. The closest Ruth and I came to knowing refuseniks was several years ago when the Ethnic Connection played for a Jewish organization in town called Hadassah. It's a Jewish women's organization. We played a lot of Jewish and Israeli music. And after the concert, a couple from Appleton, Wisconsin came to us and said, "Do you have a tape of your music?" And we said, "No, not yet." And they said, "These people have been to the Soviet Union, and these people were very much into the Jewish issue in the Soviet Union." They said they had met a Jewish violinist in Erevan, Armenia, who wanted a tape of Jewish freilachs. These are Jewish wedding dance type music. Whether we could make up a tape for him, and they would arrange for some Jewish tourist to deliver it. So we made up this tape from recordings, and we threw a few Ethnic Connection pieces in there. A few months later, Ruth and I decided to tour the Soviet Union. And we thought we'd deliver the tape ourselves. So we asked for the tape back, which they gave us. They also gave us a list of refuseniks in every town we were going to visit. They told us, however, before you do anything, you must go down to Chicago to visit a committee of Soviet Jewry. So we phoned them. And over the phone, they just scared the pants off us. They said there are new rules. You have to be very careful. You may endanger these refuseniks. So all we wanted to do is deliver a tape of Jewish music to a musician who wasn't even a refusenik. So we just got frightened by this and never pursued visiting these people. We noticed, however, that the person we were supposed to visit in Tbilisi, Georgia, was a Jewish fellow called Grigory Goldstein. And the other day, we came across an article in a magazine that indicated that Grigory Goldstein had been released from the Soviet Union and was now on a speaking tour of the United States. What the article was about is Goldstein claimed that in order to get his immigration visa, he was forced to testify against another refusnik who was sent to jail. And he wants to announce publicly that what he said was untrue at this particular time. Gregory Goldstein and his brother were the leaders of the Georgian Helsinki Watch Committee. Many cities in Russia had these dissidents who reported on human rights violations in the Soviet Union and apparently were transmitting this to foreigners. This is considered anti-Soviet propaganda and agitation for which you can get a jail sentence. So we almost met Gregory Goldstein. Yuri Orlov, by the way, was head of the Moscow branch of the Helsinki Watch Committee. Oh, you know, there was this meeting in Helsinki that the Soviet Union, the United States, and many other countries attended. And at this meeting, they established a Declaration of Human Rights. Russia signed it also. These committees were determined to check and see whether the Soviet Union follows the Helsinki principles and report violations of it. Before I talk about Mark Asbell, I'd like to give you a little survey of the situation that the Jews face both in Tsarist Russia and in modern-day Soviet Union. What I'll do is I'll intersperse my talk with playing some Jewish or parts of Jewish folk songs that in some way illustrate what I'm going to say. And I'm going to start by playing a tape of a Jewish tune called Unser Rebbenu. Rebbenu is the affectionate way of saying rabbi. Unser Rebbenu means my dear little rabbi. And there are just two words in the song. The two words are Unser Rebbenu. If you want to sing along, you're free to do so. And you can just imagine this is a song in Tsarist Russia of a Jewish tailor at his little sewing machine or housewife preparing a meal, just humming along this tune. I doubt whether anyone in the Soviet Union sings this tune anymore because there aren't too many rabbis. There are synagogues and rabbis, but there isn't a single rabbinical seminary in a Soviet Union. You have to go to Budapest, Hungary in order to get training and confirmed. And every year there are a few Soviet rabbis who go to Hungary and then go back to the Soviet Union. Thank you. There's no record of any time in the history of Jews in Europe or Russia in which there was a period, an extended period of comfort and security. The history of Jews has always vacillated between tolerance at times and repression or sheer terror at others. Over the centuries, Jews were expelled from England, from Spain, and they moved into France and Germany. And in the 17th century, the Polish aristocracy invited the Jews to come into Poland, which they did. The object was to help establish a middle class in Poland, which didn't exist at the time. The Jews were about the only people in those days who were literate. They could read and write. Every Jewish son has to learn how to read and write. And because of this, a number of Jews got jobs by these Polish aristocrats as tax collectors and as managers of estates. So you had this situation in which the poor Polish peasant who was suffering under these lords, the ones they faced were the Jewish rent collector and tax collector. And instead of expressing their antagonism toward the landlord, they expressed it against the Jews. Someone has once said that anti-Semitism is a socialism of fools. And this is a good example of it, despite the fact that the overwhelming majority of Jews were poor slobs who, if anything, were taxed even more than the Polish peasants. Jews were forced to live in a pale of settlement. The word pale is like the word palisade. It means an enclosure. From the Baltic Sea to the Black Sea, they could only live in these little villages called shtetlach, or shtetl. They were not allowed to own any land. All sorts of taxes were imposed on them. In 1830 or so, Nicholas II set up 600 anti-Jewish laws restricting the Jews. Jewish children were often kidnapped at the age of 9 or 10, dragged to the river, baptized, and then sent to the army. And they had to walk sometimes hundreds of miles to reach the army post. Dostoevsky, in one of his books, describes the pitiful state of these Jewish kids, most of them dying of hunger, malnutrition, just dropping by the wayside, walking toward their army posts. In the army, they weren't allowed to speak Yiddish. Jews, as I said, lived in these small villages, the shtetl, in abject poverty. We in the Ethnic Connection used to play and sing a song called Montik Bulba, which means potatoes Monday. And the words are potatoes on Monday, potatoes Tuesday, potatoes on Wednesday. Thursday and Friday, also potatoes. But Saturday, for a change, a potato pudding. Sunday, once again, potatoes. Often a meal consisted of a potato dropped in hot water. Rabbis were never paid. They had to scrounge their living by teaching Hebrew to children or working as cobblers, tailors. I'd like to now play a song describing the poverty of the Jews. It's called A Geneva, which means a robbery. And the words are, by mein Rebbe is gewesen a Geneva. At my rabbi, a robbery took place. And what did the thief steal? He stole some shirts and discovered there were big holes in them. He stole a candlestick, and when he put it on a table, it couldn't stand straight and flipped over. He stole a chicken, and it was diseased. Here's a Geneva in the form of a lively freilach, a wedding dance. This is the type of music we were going to make a tape of to send to that Armenian Jew. Thank you. pretty lively song for a robbery. With the exception of a few years during the reign of Alexander II, who freed the serfs, Jews were never allowed to enter universities unless they converted to the Russian Orthodox Church. This was generally true throughout Europe. In Germany, for example, Heinrich Heine converted for obvious opportunistic reasons. Karl Marx's father did. Felix Mendelssohn's father all converted to Lutheranism in order to get into the professions. A well-known professor in 1905 of philology, Martin Qualson, said, "I decided to become baptized into the Russian Orthodox Church out of conviction, the conviction that it was much better to be a professor at the University of St. Petersburg than spend one's life teaching Hebrew to poor Jewish children in a shtetl." This was his conviction. Anti-Semitism was rampant. If you'd like to read a short story that beats any Nazi short story on anti-Semitism, read a story by Turgenev called A Jew. Boy, is that a lulu of a story. It's about a Jewish person who not only is a traitor, a spy for an enemy country, but he has converted his daughter into prostitution and he is a pimp for his daughter. This is some of the milder aspects of the story. Turgenev the Jew, you can get it in any library here. Nikolai Gogol, famous writer, wrote a story called Taras Bulba in which he describes with great relish the atrocities of a pogrom. Various czars and the heads of the church deliberately provoked pogroms in order to deflect the anger of the poor Russian people against their oppressors. Jews were often, ironically, accused of the same libels that the early Christians were accused of by the Romans, namely by shedding blood in order to use the blood in rituals. A grandmother would scare a child at night and say, "Go to bed. If you don't, the zhid will get you." The zhid is the Russian word for kike, Z-H-I-D. Well, during the 19th and early 20th century, millions of Jews left Russia, most of them coming to the United States. With the fall of Tsarism and the triumph of the Bolsheviks, a new dawn opened for the Jewish people. Lenin was strongly anti-Semitic. It became a crime, you could be sent to jail for using the word zhid. The Pale of Settlement was eliminated and Jews could move anywhere. The universities were open to them. Many of the leaders of the Bolshevik Revolution were Jews. The first president of the Soviet Union was a Jewish fellow called Sverdlov. In 1960, we old timers maybe remember, when Eisenhower was meeting with Khrushchev in one of the summit meetings and they shot down this spy plane of Francis Power, that plane landed in Sverdlovsk, the town named after Sverdlov. The first foreign minister of the Soviet Union was Leon Trotsky. The first head of the Comintern was a Jew, Zinoviev. When Maxim Litvinov was ambassador to the United States, the Soviet Foreign Office was laughingly referred to as the synagogue because so many of the foreign diplomats were Jewish. There were Yiddish schools set up all throughout the country. There were departments of Jewish studies, just as we have Department of Women's Studies and African Studies, they had Department of Women of Jewish Studies. In towns that had large Jewish populations, like Minsk and Kiev, Jewish parents could elect to send their children to public school in which Yiddish was the language spoken rather than Russian. There are many theater groups, Yiddish theater groups sprung up. A number of Jews decided to become farmers, a trade forbidden to them over the centuries, despite the fact that the biblical Jews were mainly farmers or herdsmen. One group of Jews set up farm communities in the Crimea, And I like to play a song of the 1920s that they sang, celebrating the fact that they're driving around on tractors, they're operating reapers and harvesters, and they are defying the libel that Jews are incapable of being farmers. The name of the song is called Zhankoye. Zhankoye is the railroad station in Crimea that the Jews would bring their produce to be sent to the market. Well, the Jews in the Soviet Union never had it so good until Stalin came along. And then there was this nosedive. First of all, there was World War II, in which 3 million Russian Jews were killed, in contrast to the Jews of the rest of Europe who were put in trains and sent to Auschwitz. The Russian Jews were wiped out on the spot. They were simply machine gunned or took out of town, lined them up, dug pits, and they were killed. The Nazis spread propaganda through leaflets and loudspeakers to the Soviet troops, declaring, "While you are dying at the front, the Jews are behind the lines making money and going to bed with your wives." This despite the fact that 500,000 Jews were in the Soviet army, and there are more medals given to Jewish soldiers than most of the other ethnic groups, percentage-wise. Over 100 Jewish generals were decorated with the Hero of the Soviet Union medal. After the war, Stalin decided to Russianize the country. Even though he was Georgian, he became super Russian. The history of Russia is filled with a debate between the Westernizers and the Slavophiles, those who are drawn toward Western liberal science and so on, versus the pro-Russian Slavic people. This was a Slavophile period. Jews were regarded as insufficiently Russian and were discriminated against. Many famous Jewish writers were simply executed during Stalin's purges. Many high-placed Jewish leaders, the whole diplomatic corps was wiped out of Jews. The crowning blow came with the so-called doctor's plot. In Leningrad, 11 doctors, 9 of whom were Jews, confessed that they had already poisoned, through medical treatment, 2 Soviet leaders and were planning to poison others. Fortunately for them, Stalin died, and a few months later, the whole plot was considered a hoax, and they were quietly freed. Now let's come back to our refusnik, Mark Asbel. Asbel was born in Kharkov in the Crimea in 1932. Both of his parents were physicians. Both of them had completely lost any trace of Jewishness. Asbel was never bar mitzvahed, never knew anything about Jewish holidays. As a matter of fact, his name Asbel is mentioned in the Israel with Moses. Asbel never knew this until he was 40 years of age, because Bibles are hard to come by. His parents were good atheistic communists. Asbel was raised as a good atheistic communist. He first found out that he was Jewish at the age of 4 when he won a game at a birthday party. Another boy said, "You won because you are a Jid." All you Yids are tricky. Asbel asked him, what is a Yid? And he was told, a Jew. It was a great surprise to Asbel. From then on, he became quite sensitive to anti-Semitic comments. One day in grade school, his teacher overheard one of the pupils say, goddamn Yid. She asked the boy to come up front, and she asked him, did you ever see a Yid? And the boy said, no, but I know they belong to the devil. And the teacher said, well, you're looking at a Yid right now. The poor kid almost had a panic reaction. In Kharkov, when Mark Asbel was a youngster, there was an incident that became quite famous throughout the Soviet Union. A much decorated Soviet veteran was walking down the street, and he was accosted by a local fellow who said, hey, Yid, where did you buy those medals? A fight ensued, and in the fight, the veteran pulled out his gun and shot and killed this man. The veteran was brought to trial, declared guilty, and was shot before a firing squad. This was an event that made quite an impression on many Jews in the Soviet Union. Mark was a genius in the field of mathematics and physics. He won every conceivable award. When he entered the University of Kharkov, he was the top person. He just excelled in these fields. He just loved science. When he entered the University of Kharkov as a physics major, the Stalin regime launched this campaign against cosmopolitanism, against any westernization of science. Scientists like Newton, Einstein, Mendel were considered bourgeois, while Lysenko, the geneticist, sort of geneticist charlatan, was one of Stalin's favorites. Any geneticist who didn't go along with Lysenko usually was fired or exiled, and a number of them committed suicide. Any historian or scientist who expressed a strong interest in Western literature was considered a cosmopolitan. The word rootless cosmopolitans became a code name for Jews, since many Jews were interested in Western science and literature. When the Ethnic Connection was looking for a name for our group, I suggested, let's call ourselves the Rootless Cosmopolitans. But I don't think the others knew the significance of Not only were many Jewish professors and professionals fired, but a policy was inaugurated that was just utterly stunned the Jews. That policy is quotas were put upon admission to universities. So today, in Moscow University, only 1% of students are Jewish. The Jews have always been a literate people. Scholarship, learning, study was always worshipped by Jews. If there ever was a Jewish god, it's education. And here, they were not allowed to enter the university except in small numbers. There are many jokes about how Jews feel about education and the professions. For example, there's a story about a frantic Jewish mother at a beach. She ran over to the lifeguard and shouted, help, help, my son, the PhD, is drowning. Three Jewish women were talking about the nachas they had about their children. Nachas means the pride and joy you have when your children work out well. One woman said, boy, do I have nachas. My son is an eminent surgeon. And the second woman said, boy, do I have nachas. My son is a law professor. And the third said, and my son is a rabbi. And the first woman said, a rabbi? Is that a field for a Jewish boy? Well, when this god of education toppled and Jewish professors began getting blacklisted from universities, Jewish parents felt that there was no future for their children. Perhaps more than anything else, this feeling that their children will not get into the professions was one of the major factors in Jews becoming disenchanted with the Soviet Union and wanting to emigrate. I brought along a picture here, or a Xerox copy of a picture. This is a picture shown to me by Henry Shapiro's wife, Ludmilla. This is the class, 1939 class of the Gorky Literary Institute. Here is Ludmilla right here. You probably can't see it. This woman here is a Jewish woman who's the wife, was the wife of Sergei Prokofiev. Ludmilla maintains that of the 31 people here, 14 of them were Jews. The fellow here is a fellow called Alexander Abramovich Anarchist. He was a very attractive fellow that all the women seem to have eyes for. He was in the army and he came home once on leave with medals and everyone was, you know, so happy to see him. But after the war, Ludmilla ran into him and he was just utterly crushed. He looked 20 years older. He was fired from his job. And Ludmilla said, well, what's going to happen? And he says, well, we have an epidemic of typhus going on. It means, you know, symbolically. I'll sort of last it through. Today, this fellow is the leading Soviet authority on Shakespeare in the Soviet Union. He's a professor at a university. When I asked Ludmilla in the 1986 class of the Gorky Literary Institute, how many of you think are Jewish? She said, who knows? She had no idea, but indicating that there are many fewer now. Other factors that led to Jews wanting to emigrate was the establishment of Israel as a state. And many Jews began having divided loyalties. The Soviet government, as you know, opposed Israel and Zionism. There were tyrants of propaganda directed against Israel and Zionism. In many newspapers, international Zionism was linked even with Nazism. There was a TV movie that appeared called Secret and Open, and they maintained that the Zionists collaborated with the Nazis in starting World War II. The reason they claimed that Eichmann was captured and executed was they were afraid if Eichmann remained alive, he would reveal the connection between the international Zionists and the Nazis. It just became utterly psychotic in some of their anti-Zionist propaganda. And to the average Russian, there's very little distinction between anti-Jewishness and anti-Zionism. There's no mention in any Russian history book of the Holocaust, of 6 million Jews who were wiped out. Ruth and I visited this area called Babi Yar outside of Kiev when we showed you our slides of our trip to the Soviet Union. We showed you a picture of the plaque that stood in front of this place where all these Jews were massacred. And the plaque said, here in 1941-43, the German fascist invaders executed more than 100,000 citizens of Kiev and prisoners of war. They didn't mention that 90,000 out of the 100,000 were Jewish. The others were captured soldiers and sailors that the Nazis simply murdered. In 1967, the Six-Day War broke out between Israel and the Arab countries. And here is how Asbel described his reaction to the Six-Day War. Remember, this is a war in which Israel was fighting against a bunch of Arab countries.
The Six-Day War was the most exciting experience of a lifetime for thousands and thousands of Soviet Jews. None of us thought of anything but the war during that agonizing week. We hovered over our radios, hardly daring to breathe. Overnight, we recognized how close was the fate of Israel to our hearts. We lived in desperate fear. We knew the Arab world was totally prepared for war, that there were 100 million Arabs and 3 million Jews. It seemed irrational to expect anything but disaster. For that reason, news of the victory came as an overwhelming surprise. It would be hard to convey the internal transformation that took place among Soviet Jews. They acquired a totally new outlook, a new soul. We're proud for the first time in centuries of being Jews, of belonging to a people who could fight against fantastic odds for their own country. What a different world it became when the most notable event in one's national consciousness was not the familiar tale of persecution and defeat, but a triumph that would live in history.
Well, there was a tremendous upsurge of Jewish consciousness among these people who never saw themselves really as Jews. Except, you know, as you may know, on every Russian's passport, there is stamped a nationality. It's known as the fifth point, Piatka Punkta. And on the passport of Jews is stamped J, meaning Jewish. Many Jews refer to themselves as cripples of the fifth point, because once you see that Jewish nationality on the passport, your chance of getting a job may diminish. So, here is a 21-year-old woman student from Tbilisi, Georgia, coming from a family that had never celebrated Jewish holidays or exhibited any signs of their Jewishness. She said, "When it was announced that the Jews had won the Six-Day War, my father brought wine. My uncle and aunt came, and we celebrated the success and the courage of Israel as if we had taken part in the war ourselves. It was then we decided to go to Israel." It was sort of a born-again experience for many Soviet Jews. Also, many Jews were very sympathetic to the Czechoslovak government under Dubček. Remember, it was called Socialism with a Human Face. This also helped a number of Jews and non-Jews to be disillusioned with the existing government. In 1970, something very startling occurred. The Voice of Israel, the shortwave radio, announced that some Soviet Jews had publicly announced that they wanted to emigrate to Israel. This was unheard of. Up until 1929, Jews or anyone else were free to leave the Soviet Union. But with Stalin, this was just cut. Here, these Jews announced they wanted to leave the Soviet Union. On top of that, they had the audacity to imply they didn't appreciate all the Soviet Union did for them, and they wanted to celebrate, to settle in a country that was the very devil in the Soviet Union's eyes, in Israel. Despite the fact that probably the majority of Soviet Jews live relatively comfortable lives, and probably most of them still support the Soviet government, the tag of disloyalty was attached to the Jews. This is like this Ivan thief business. And a vicious circle developed, as so often vicious circles develop in human relations. The Jews were tagged as being disloyal and therefore discriminated against. Because they were discriminated against, they became more prone toward Israel. And as they became more prone toward Israel, they were more disloyal. So it just went round and round. When I was a marriage counselor, I could give you many examples of marriages in which vicious circles go on, and how to crack that terrible vicious circle between husbands and wives. In June 1970, another fantastic thing happened. 11 Jews in Leningrad hijacked an Aeroflot plane and tried to fly it to Sweden. Two of the Jews were former Air Force pilots. Well, they were caught, and they were sentenced to die. There was tremendous uproar throughout the Western world, and Brezhnev, who at the time was interested in detente and having better relations with the West, freed those two who were sentenced to die in exchange for two Russian spies who were in the United States. You get this, these exchanges have been going on for many years. After a few Jews were allowed to emigrate, thousands of applications were submitted. Orchestra leaders, ballet dancers, writers, scientists, ordinary Jews, so many of them applied. One of them was a person called Felix Kandel. I'm sure most of you, of us, have never heard of Felix Kandel. The reason I mention it, one of the pins that Ruth picked up in the Soviet Union was a little pin of a rabbit. And this pin was very famous because the rabbit, who was sort of like the roadrunner, part of a TV series called Just Wait, New Pagoda, in which this clever hare was able to escape from a wolf. Felix Candel applied and was given permission to leave. During World War III, there were three famous war heroes called the Three Minsk Colonels. They were all Jewish. One of them had died of a heart problem. The other two applied for admission to leave, and they were given permission. So, under Brezhnev, about 200,000 Jews were allowed to leave. As soon as Reagan came along, it trickled down to practically zero. Obviously, the whole Jewish issue has been tied in with the Cold War, and to me, the obvious solution to some sort of help is the more we get along better with the Soviet Union, the more Jews will be allowed to leave. Asbel was very open in his opposition to Soviet repression. He was fired from many jobs. He was very friendly with Sakharov, with Sharansky, and with Yuri Orlov, who was also a physicist. Asbel knew Orlov quite well. At one time, Asbel was told that if he testified against Sharansky, he would be allowed to leave the country, but he refused to do so. Asbel also wrote a play called Bertolt Brecht, a play that, not Bertolt Brecht, called Galileo, a play that Bertolt Brecht had also written, dealing with the conflict between science and the state. This play never was published in the Soviet Union. So Asbel applied for emigration, for a visa, and it was turned down. He became a refusenik. Most refuseniks are turned down or in the field of science because they are considered security risks, that they, like Sakharov, they know Soviet secrets. Asbel was not a security risk. He was a theoretical physicist. His specialty was the electrons and metals and DNA, so it had nothing to do with security. The reason they didn't allow him to leave is when you apply for emigration, you have to fill out all sorts of forms. You have to get the approval of many employers and family members. His father-in-law, the father of his first wife, who had long since he had divorced, refused to sign it. And this was the reason that he was not allowed to go. Well, there he was stuck, as I say, trapped in the Soviet Union. And what he and nine other scientists did is they set up weekly seminars in order to keep their knowledge of science going. Orlov, frequently, who was a physicist, attended these seminars. These seminars became world famous. They would telephone the goings-on of the seminars to Israel, and Israel would send it to the United States, and it became quite well known. A number of these seminars were offered professorships in Israel and the United States. And many prominent scientists of the West dropped in. For example, Howard Temin of the University of Wisconsin, our great Nobel laureate, attended a number of times, gave lectures on cancer, on his work, to this group. In order to call greater attention to themselves, this seminar decided to have a hunger strike. And this hunger strike was announced throughout the Western world, and they stopped eating. A few days later, they got a telephone call from the rabbi, the chief rabbi of Israel, a fellow called Goren, who congratulated them on their hunger strike, but he wanted to point out something to them in case they didn't know, namely that the next day was a Sabbath, and it was a desecration of the Sabbath if you fast. These guys were tearing their hair out. Here they were on this hunger strike. It was, everyone in the world seemed to know about it. And this rabbi told them, you'll have to stop fasting on the Sabbath. And over the phone, they began arguing with the rabbi. They say, well, you were a chaplain during the Six-Day War. Did you and the troops fast on the Sabbath in the middle of the war? And he said, no, but that was a war. And they convinced him that this was also a war. So the rabbi said, okay, it's a war, you can fast. It was kosher. finally, in 1977, after 5 years as a refusenik, Asbel and his family got approval to leave, and they went to Israel. He got offers for jobs at MIT and University of California, but he preferred to go to the University of Tel Aviv. 2 years ago, I remember seeing a sign on one of the bulletins in the university announcing a talk given by Mark Asbel. At the time, I really didn't know who he was, so I never attended. But the physics department invited him to talk here. So on July 5th, 1977, Asbel, his wife, his daughter, and his cat said farewell to their many friends at the Moscow airport, many friends including Zakharov and his Jewish wife, Elena Bonner. He boarded an Aeroflot plane which took off for Israel, and his years of captivity were over. What I'd like to do is play a little Russian song just to indicate the dilemma many Jews had in leaving Russia. Even though many Jews have left Russia, they still feel very strongly about Russia. They are culturally Russian. It was their native language. And this is a piece called Kalinka, played by an American group called the Odessa Balalaikas. This is a group of Jewish Soviet musicians who settled in San Francisco, reflecting this ambivalence between their homelands.
Thank you.
we're going to close with a little reading, an excerpt from an essay by a 13-year-old Jewish girl in the Soviet Union, an essay called I Have Two Homelands.
I have two homelands. My homeland has given me a lot, a high school education, the musical school, films for children, and other things. Yet the same homeland has given me other things too, the refusal to let us go to my real homeland. It has almost deprived us of any income. It does not let my father work in his profession that he loves so much. It is preventing me from learning the language and the culture of my people. It spreads lies about our family in the newspaper and throws mud at us. I remember the gatherings, the interesting trips to the country, but I also remember other things, the swearing and scandals at school, the insults and the fights. There are two sides to life, a rosy side and a dark side.
Well, on that profound last statement, we'll end our talk. Okay, why don't we have a few minutes for discussion? Comments? Rosa?
George, a while ago you mentioned that there was a period of more latitude for the Jews in Russia when they could become, they decided to become farmers. Do you know why it was that they had not been permitted to farm? That's an unusual thing. I can understand why they weren't permitted to go to universities or have more land. Why were they not permitted to have farming? Control of food?
You mean in the past?
Yeah. You would think they almost might be relegated to the land because it could be a very poor living. Yeah. But you say they were forbidden. And I wonder why that was.
I really can't give you... Does anyone know?
That was traditional throughout Europe. Land was seen as a source of status, and so the Jews were, in all countries, as far as I know, were forbidden to own land. It was also a source of power. And there were very, very many restrictions throughout all of Europe on all kinds of things the Jews could do, and they didn't really start lessening until around the Napoleonic Wars and the aftermath of that.
So the ownership was the thing behind it, really. Yeah. Not so much the farmer, but the right to own land and own the product.
Yeah, but I think even more, there was a mentality that Jews were just to be totally restricted in things, that Jews were useful because they were allowed, well, first to lend money at interest, and other people were not, and they became useful that way. They also they took on unpleasant occupations, so people wanted to get rid of them. Like the Polish aristocracy were very anti-Semitic, but they, and rather than having a native middle class come in, which would gain power, they brought the Jews in to do this because they would not gain power because they were aliens in effect. So there was a general attitude throughout all of Christian Europe of restricting the Jews as much as possible. They would have liked to have eliminated them, but they couldn't.
It looked like they might have worked with them, but they said it's okay to come in and pay lower wages to do the dirty work, but it's not okay to stay and raise your status.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the Jews had to be very mobile in many of those societies because they never knew when they were just going to be expelled. And it could be tomorrow that they had to be gone. So if they were tied to the land, when, as money dealers, they could pick up the bag of money and run, but they couldn't do that.
I would like to mention that even though Jews were usurers, Christians weren't allowed to lend money with interest, they were a very tiny percent of the Jewish population. Throughout the Middle Ages, the Jews, like in the Fiddler on the Roof, there wasn't a money lender there. They were milkmen, tailors. During the Middle Ages, the Jews were the acrobats very often, the ballet dance masters, painters. They fit into any occupation that was available for them, but most of them were very ordinary working people living in poverty. So there is this stereotype of the Jew as the user.
You mentioned Fiddler on the Roof, and as I remember the film, the daddy sent the parent to the child.
he delivered, no, he had a cow. See, they lived in the shtetlach. The shtetl was small villages, like farms, see. But they didn't plow the land. They weren't allowed to.
Well,